This is Eunice Scarfe reading the second in two nights of Stories for Peace. Last night, Obasan by Joy Kogawa, and tonight, the story, Horses of the Night, from the collection Bird in the House by Margaret Lawrence. Margaret Lawrence is about 60. She writes out of Manitoba. She's created a fictional world of Manawanka. And all of these stories in this collection take place in that town. All are featuring Vanessa, the child in the family. We call them in Canada the Vanessa stories. The one tonight is when her cousin, she meets her cousin, and he is faced with being conscripted into World War II and the effects on him. So we are dealing with, again, the issue of war's effects on the individual. Margaret Lawrence's other most prominent book is A Stone Angel, which is Hagar, a middle-aged woman, looking back on her life, and she identifies with the stone angel in the cemetery of the prairie town. And Hagar is chosen very deliberately from the biblical antecedent. And if you were to look at one Margaret Lawrence, I'd look at the Stone Angel. No, I'd look at two. I'd look at this collection and the Stone Angel. So, Horses of the Night. I never knew I had distant cousins who lived up north until Chris came down to Manawanka to go to high school. My mother said he belonged to a large family, relatives of ours, who lived at Shallow Creek up north. I was six, and Shallow Creek seemed immeasurably far, part of a legendary winter country where no leaves grow, and where the breath of seals and polar bears snuffled out steamily and turned to ice. Could plain people live there? I asked my mother, meaning people who were not Eskimos. Could there be a farm up there? How do you mean? She said, puzzled. I told you that's where they live, on the farm. Uncle Wilf, that was Chris's father who died a few years back. He got the place as a homestead, donkeys years ago. But how could they grow anything? I thought you said it was up north. Mercy, my mother said, laughing, it's not that far north, Vanessa. It's about 100 miles beyond Galloping Mountain. You be nice to Chris now, won't you? And don't go asking him a whole lot of questions the minute he steps inside the door. How little my mother knew of me, I thought. Chris had been 15. He could be expected to feel only scorn towards me. I detested the fact that I was so young. I did not think I would be able to say anything at all to him. What if I don't like him? What if you don't? My mother responded sharply. You're to watch your manners and no acting up, understand? It's going to be quite difficult enough without that. Why does he have to come here anyway? I demanded crossly. Why can't he go to school where he lives? Because there isn't any high school up there, my mother said. I hope he gets on well here and isn't too homesick. 3 years is a long time. It's very good of your grandfather to let him stay here at the brick house. She said this last accusingly, as though she suspected I might be thinking differently. But I had not thought of it one way or another. We were all having dinner at the brick house because of Chris's arrival. It was the end of August and sweltering. My grandfather's house looked huge and cool from the outside, the high, low-sweeping spruce trees shutting out the sun with their dusky, outfanned branches. But inside it wasn't cool at all. The wood stove in the kitchen was going full blast, and the whole place smelled of roasting meat. Grandmother Connor was wearing a large mauve apron. I thought it was a nicer color than the dark bottle green of her dress, but she believed in wearing somber shades lest the spirit give way to vanity, which in her case was not much of a risk. The apron came up over her shapeless bosom and obscured part of her cameo brooch, the only jewelry she ever wore, with its portrait of a fiercely bearded man whom I imagined to be either Moses or God. Isn't it nearly time for them to be getting here, Beth? Grandmother Connor asked. Train's not due until 6, my mother said. It's barely 5:30 now. Has Father gone to the station already? He went an hour ago, my grandmother said. He would, my mother commented. Now, Beth, my grandmother cautioned and soothed. At last the front screen door was hurled open and Grandfather Connor strode into the house, followed by a tall, lanky boy. Chris was wearing a white shirt, a tie, gray trousers. I thought unwillingly that he looked handsome. His face was angular, the bones showing through the brown skin. His gray eyes were slightly slanted and his hair was the color of couch grass at the end of a summer when it has been bleached to a light yellow by the sun. I had not planned to like him, not even a little. But somehow I wanted to defend him when I heard what my mother whispered to my grandmother before they went into the front hall. Heavens, look at the shirt and trousers. Must have been his father's, the poor kid. I shot out into the hall ahead of my mother and then stopped and stood there. "Hi, Vanessa," Chris said. "How come you knew who I was?" I asked. "Well, I knew your mother and dad only had one of a family, so I figured you must be her," he replied, grinning. The way he spoke did not make me feel I had blundered. My mother greeted him warmly but shyly. Not knowing if she were expected to kiss him or to shake hands, she finally did neither. Grandmother Connor, however, had no doubts. She kissed him on both cheeks and then held him at arm's length to have a proper look at him. "Bless the child," she said. Coming from anyone else, this remark would have sounded ridiculous, especially as Chris was at least a head taller than she. My grandmother was the only person I had ever known who could say such things without appearing false. "I'll show you your room, Chris," my mother offered. Grandfather Connor, who had been standing in the living room doorway in absolute silence, looking as granite as a statue in the cemetery, now followed grandmother out to the kitchen. "Train was 40 minutes late," he said weightily. "What a shame," my grandmother said. "But I thought it wasn't due until 6, Timothy." "6," my grandfather cried. "That's the mainline train. The local was due at 5:30. This was not correct, as both my grandmother and I knew, but neither of us contradicted him. "What on earth are you cooking a roast for on a night like this?" my grandfather went on. "A person could fry an egg on the sidewalk. It's that hot. Potato salad would have been all right." Privately, I agreed with this opinion, but I could never permit myself to acknowledge agreement with him on anything. I automatically and emotionally sided with grandmother in all issues, not because she was right, but because I loved her. "It's not a roast," my grandmother said mildly. "It's mock duck. The stove's only been going for an hour. I thought the boy would be hungry after the trip." My mother and Chris had come downstairs and were now in the living room. I could hear them there, talking awkwardly with pauses. "Potato salad," my grandfather declaimed, "would have been plenty good enough. He'd have been lucky to get it, if you ask me. His family hasn't got 2 cents to rub together. It's me that's paying for the boy's keep." The thought of Chris in the living room and my mother unable to explain was too much for me. I sidled over to the kitchen door, intending to close it, but my grandmother stopped me. "No," she said with unexpected firmness. "Leave it open, Vanessa." I could hardly believe it. Surely she wouldn't want Chris to hear. She herself was always able to move with equanimity through a hurricane because she believed that a mighty fortress was her god. But the rest of us were not like that, and usually she did her best to protect us. At the time, I felt only bewilderment. I think now that she must have realized Chris would have to learn the brick house ways sooner or later, and he might as well start right away. On the rare evenings when my parents went out, Chris would come over to mind me. These were the best times, for often when he was supposed to be doing his homework, he would make fantastic objects for my amusement on his own. Pipe cleaners twisted into the shape of wildly prancing midget men, or an old set of Christmas tree lights fixed onto a puppet theater with a red velvet curtain that really pulled. He had skill in making miniature things of all kinds. Once for my birthday, he gave me a leather saddle no bigger than a matchbox, which he had sewn himself, complete in every detail, stirrups and horn, with the crisscross lines that were the brand name of his ranch. "Can I go to Shallow Creek sometime?" I asked one evening. "Sure, some summer holiday maybe. I've got a sister about your age. The others are all grown up." And then I asked him what it was like. "Tell me what it's like to live there, Chris." I could see it. The trees were still growing and the leaves were firmly and greenly on them. The branches had been coaxed into formations of towers and high-up nests where you could look out and see for 100 miles or more at his house. "That lake, you know," Chris said, "it's more like an Indian sea. It goes on forever and ever, amen, that's how it looks. And you know what? Millions of years ago, before there were any human beings at all, the lake was full of water monsters, all different kind of dinosaurs. And then they all died off. Nobody knows why. Imagine them, all those huge creatures with necks like snakes, and some of them had hackles on their heads, like a rooster's comb, only very tough, like hard leather. Some guys from Winnipeg came up a few years back and dug up dinosaur bones, and they found footprints in the rocks." Footprints in the rocks? I could only nod, fascinated and horrified. Imagine going swimming in those waters. What if one of the creatures had lived on? "Tell me about the horses up there," I said. "Oh, them. Well, we've got these 2 riding horses, Duchess and Firefly. I raised them, and you should see them. Really sleek, know what I mean? I bet I could make racers out of them." He He missed the horses, I felt, with selfish satisfaction, more than he missed his family. When can I go, Chris? Well, we'll have to see. After I get through high school, I won't be at Shallow Creek much. Why not? Because, Chris said, what I'm going to be is an engineer, a civil engineer. You ever seen a really big bridge, Vanessa? Well, I haven't either, but I've seen pictures. You take the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco now, terrifically high. All those thin ribs of steel. It doesn't seem possible, but it's there. That's what engineers do. Where will you go, I asked. Winnipeg, he said, to college. The depression did not get better, as everyone had been saying it would. It got worse, and so did the drought. The farms around Manawaka never had a total crop failure, and afterwards, when the drought was over, people used to remark on this fact proudly, as though it had been due to some virtue or special status, like the children of Israel being afflicted by Jehovah, but never in any real danger of annihilation. But although Manawaka never knew the worst, what it knew was bad enough, or so I learned later. What I really saw was only what went on in our family. He's done quite well all through, despite everything, my mother said. She sighed, and I knew she was talking about Chris. We were sitting in the living room, and it was evening. My father was slouched in the gray armchair, and this is sometime later, she jumps ahead into the depression. My mother was slenderly straight-backed in the blue chair in which nobody else ever sat. I was sitting on the footstool. I was pretending to be coloring into a scribbler on my knee. To speak would be to invite a dismissal, but their words forced questions into my head. Chris isn't going away, is he? My mother swooped, shocked at her own neglect. My heavens, are you still up, Vanessa? What am I thinking of? Where is Chris going? I said. We're not sure yet, my mother evaded, pushing me up the stairs. We'll see. He would not go, I thought. Something would happen miraculously to prevent him. He would remain with his long, loping walk and his half-slanted gray eyes and his talk that never excluded me. He would stay right here. And soon I would be able to reply with such a lightning burst of knowingness that it would astound him when he spoke of the space or the black sky or all the other stories that he would tell me. Soon I would be able to talk to him. I was 9 when Chris left Manawaka. The day before he was due to go, I knocked on the door of his room in the brick house. Come in, Chris said. I'm packing. Do you know how to fold socks, Vanessa? Sure, of course. Well, fold that bunch over there, then. I had come to say goodbye, but I did not want to say it yet, so I got to work on the socks. I did not intend to speak about the matter of college, but the knowledge that I must not speak about it made me uneasy. My mother had said, he's taken it amazingly well. He doesn't even mention it, so we mustn't either. Tomorrow night you'll be back in Shallow Creek, I ventured. Yeah. He did not look up. He went on stuffing clothes and books into his suitcase. I bet you'll be glad to see the horses, eh? I said. I bet you won't mind about not going to college just to see your horses. I wanted him to say he didn't care about the horses anymore and he'd rather stay here. Oh, yeah, it'll be good to see them again, Chris said. Could you hand over those socks, Vanessa? Everything's in. I sat on his suitcase for him so it would close, and then he tied a piece of rope around it because the lock wouldn't lock. Ever thought what it would be like to be a traveler, Vanessa? He asked. I thought of Richard Halliburton taking an elephant over the Alps and swimming in the Taj Mahal lily pool by moonlight. It'd be keen, I said, because this was the word Chris used to describe the best possible thing. That's what I'm going to do someday. He did not say, as I feared he might, that girls could not be travelers. Why not, he said. Sure you will if you really want to. I got this theory, see, that anybody can do anything at all, anything, if they really set their minds to it. But you have to have this total concentration. You have to focus on it with your whole mental powers and not let it slip away by forgetting. If you hold it in your mind, it's real. You take most people now. They can't concentrate worth a darn. Do you think I can? I inquired eagerly. What? He said. Oh, sure. Sure, Vanessa. Sure, I think you can. Naturally. Chris did not write after he left Manawaka. About a month later, we had a letter from his mother. He was not at Shallow Creek. He had not gone back. He had got off the northbound train at the first stop after Manawaka, cashed in his ticket, and thumbed a lift to Winnipeg. He'd written from there but given no address. What can we do? He's nearly 18, said my father. What he does is his own business. Simmer down, Beth, and let's decide what we're going to tell your father, Grandpa O'Connor. I went without either of them noticing. I walked to the hill at the edge of the town and down into the valley where the scrub oak and poplar grew almost to the banks of the Wanaka River. I found the oak where we had gone last autumn. I climbed to the lowest branch and stayed there for a while. I was not consciously thinking about Chris, but when at last I cried, I felt relieved and could go home again. Chris departed from my mind after that with a quickness that was due to the other things that were happening. When I was 11, almost 2 years after Chris had left, he came back without warning. I came home from school and found him sitting in our living room. I could not accept that I had nearly forgotten him. Now he was present. He was wearing a navy blue serge suit. I was old enough now to notice it was a cheap one and had been worn a considerable time. Otherwise, he looked the same smile, the same knife-boned face with no flesh to speak of, the same unresting eyes. "How come you're here?" I cried. "Where have you been?" "I'm a traveler," he said, "remember?" He was a traveler, all right, a traveling salesman. Chris was selling vacuum cleaners. That evening he brought out his line and showed us. Showed my mother, tried to sell her one. I bet you'll sell 1,000, Chris." 2 years before, this statement would have seemed self-evident, unquestionable. Yet now, when I had spoken, I knew that I did not believe it. The next time Chris visited, he was selling magazines. After my father died, the whole order of life was torn. Nothing was known or predictable any longer. For months, I lived almost entirely within myself. So when my mother told me one day that Chris couldn't find any work at all because there were now no jobs, and he'd gone back to Shallow Creek to stay, it made scarcely any impression on me. But that summer, my mother decided I ought to go away for a holiday. She hoped it would take my mind off my father's death. What, if anything, was going to take her mind off his death, she did not say. "Would you like to go to Shallow Creek?" she asked me. I could write to Chris's mother. Then I remembered, all in a torrent, the way I had imagined it once, when he used to tell me about it, the house fashioned of living trees, the lake like a sea where monsters had dwelt, the grass like green wavering light where the horses flew in the splendor of their pride. "Yes," I said, "I'll go, write to her." The railway did not go through Shallow Creek, but Chris met me at Challoner's Crossing. He looked different, not only thinner, but different. "Come on, kid," he said, "the limousine's over here." It was a wagon and two horses, but the nature of each one was not what I had expected. The wagon was long and clumsy. "Allow me to introduce you," Chris said. "This is Floss and Trooper. This is Vanessa." He did not mention his other horses that he told me about, Duchess and Firefly, and neither did I. Not all the fortnight I was there. I guess I had known for some years now, without realizing it, that the pair had only ever existed in some other dimension. Shallow Creek wasn't a town. It was merely a name on a map. There was a grade school a few miles away, but that was all. It was perfectly true that the house was made out of trees. It was a fair-sized but elderly shack, made out of poplar poles and chinked with mud. There was an upstairs, with three bedrooms, one of which I had to share with Sister Jeannie. Aunt Tess, Chris's mother, was severe in manner and yet wanting to be kind, worrying, making tentative overtures which were either ignored or repelled by her daughters. Youngsters swam in and out of the house like shoals of nameless fishes. I could not see how so many people could live here under one roof, but then I learned they didn't. The married daughters lived nearby, but came back for communal living and eating together. Chris took no part at all, none. When he spoke, it was usually to the children, and they would often follow him around the yard or to the barn, not pestering, but just trailing along in clusters. He never told them to go away. The house had no screens on the doors or windows, and at mealtimes the flies were so numerous you could hardly see the food, for all of the black-blue bodies squirming all over it. Nobody noticed my squeaminess except Chris. "Fan it with your hand," he murmured. "It's okay," I said quickly. For the first time in all the years we had known each other, we could not look each other in the eye. The children stabbed and sniveled until Chris's older sister, driven frantic, would shriek, "Shut up, shut up, shut up." And Chris would begin asking me about Manawanka then as though nothing were going on. "Could I go haying with you?" I said the next day. "Please, Chris, please, I won't be any trouble, I promise." Finally, he agreed. When we got there, the hayfields lay beside the lake. It was my first view of the water, which Chris had described years ago. No human word could be applied. The lake was not lonely or untamed. There was no feeling about the place. It existed in some world in which man was not yet born. I looked at the gray reaches of it and felt threatened. It was like the view of God which I had held since my father's death. Distant, indestructible, totally indifferent. "We're not going to camp here, are we?" I asked and pleaded, knowing we had to spend one night before we got to finish the hay. "No," he said, "I just want to let the horses drink. We'll camp up there on the bluff." Chris worked through the hours of sun while I lay on the half-formed stack of hay and looked up at the sky. The blue air trembled and spun. In the evening, Chris took the horses to the lake again. He made a fire and we had coffee and a tin of stew and then we went to bed. We did not wash and we slept in our clothes. It was only when I was curled up uncomfortably with the itching blanket around me that I felt a sense of unfamiliarity at being here, with Chris only 3 feet away, a self-consciousness I would not have felt even the year before. I do not think he felt this sexual strangeness. If he wanted me not to be a child, and he did, it was not with the wish that I would be a woman. It was something else. "Are you asleep, Vanessa?" he asked. "No, I think I'm lying on a tree root." "Well, shift yourself then," he said. "Listen, I never said anything before because I really didn't know what to say, but you know how I felt about your dad dying, don't you?" "Yes," I said chokingly. "It's okay, I know. I used to talk with him sometimes. He didn't see what I was driving at, but he'd always listen, you know. You don't find many guys like that." "Look," Chris said finally, "ever noticed how much brighter the stars are when you're completely away from any houses? Even the lamps up at the farm, there, they make enough of a glow to keep you from seeing properly, like you can out here. What do they make you think about, Vanessa?" "Well..." And he goes on, "I guess most people don't give them much thought at all, except maybe to say, very pretty, or like that. But the point is, they aren't like that. The stars and planets are just not like that. Not pretty, for heaven's sake. They're gigantic, some of them burning. Imagine them tearing through space and made out of pure fire. Can you see it, Vanessa? But somebody will know what it's like someday. I really do believe that. Do you ever think about that kind of thing?" He was 21. The distance between us was still too great. For years I'd wanted to be older so I might talk with him, but now I felt unready. "Sometimes," I said, making it sound like never, never. "People usually say there must be a God," Chris went on, "because otherwise how did the universe get here? But that's ridiculous. If the stars and planets go on to infinity, they could have existed forever, for no reason at all. Maybe they weren't ever created. Look, what's the alternative? To believe in a God who's brutal. What else could he be? You've only got to look around you. It would be an insult to him to believe in a God like that. Most people don't like talking about this kind of thing, Vanessa. It embarrasses them, you know, or else they're not interested. But about God, though, if there's a war, like it looks there will be, would people claim that was planned? What kind of a God would pull a trick like that? And yet, you know, plenty of guys would think it was a godsend, and who's to say they're wrong? It would be a job, and you'd get around and travel and see places." He paused as though wanting me to say something. I didn't. "Your dad told me about the war, last war, once. He hardly ever talked about it, but this once he told me about seeing the horses in the mud, actually going under, you know, and the way their eyes looked when they realized they weren't going to get out. Ever seen horses' eyes when they're afraid? I mean, really berserk with fear, like in a bushfire? Ewan said a guy tended to concentrate on the horses because he didn't dare think what was happening to the men, including himself. What do you think? What do you think, Vanessa?" I did not know. I resented Chris's facing me with these things. I took refuge in pretending to be asleep, and after a while he stopped talking. Chris left Shallow Creek some months after the war began and joined the army. After his basic training, he was sent to England. We did not hear from him until about a year later, when a letter arrived for me. "Vanessa, what's wrong?" my mother asked. "Nothing." "Don't fib," she said firmly. "What did Chris say in his letter, honey?" "Not much." She would never have demanded to see the letter. I didn't show it to her, and she didn't ask it again. 6 months later, my mother heard from Aunt Tess. Chris had been sent home from England and discharged from the army because of a mental breakdown. He was now in the provincial mental hospital, and they did not know how long he would have to remain there. He had been violent before, but now he was not violent. He was, the doctors had told his mother, passive. Violent, I could not associate the word with Chris, who had been so much the reverse. I could not bear to consider what anguish must have catapulted him into that even greater anguish. But the way he was now seemed almost worse. How might he be? Sitting quite still, wearing the hospital's gray dressing gown, the animation gone from his face. When I think of you, my mother said, going up to Shallow Creek. I also was thinking of Shallow Creek. For the first time I recognized, at least a little, the dimensions of his need to talk to me that night. He must have understood perfectly well how impossible it would be to talk to a 13-year-old. But there was no one else for him. All his life's choices had grown narrower and narrower. He had been forced to return to the alien lake of home, and when finally he saw a means of getting away, it could only be into a turmoil which appalled him and which he dreaded even more than he knew. I had listened to his words, but I had not really heard them, not until now. It would not have made much difference to what happened, but I wished it were not too late to let him know that I had listened. Once when I was on holiday from college, my mother got me to help her clean out the attic. We sifted through boxes full of junk. I found the miniature saddle that Chris had made for me. "Have you heard anything recently?" I asked, ashamed that I had not asked sooner. She glanced up at me. "Just the same. It's always the same. They don't think there will be much improvement." Then she turned away. He always used to seem so hopeful, even when there was nothing really to hope about. That's what I find so strange. He seemed hopeful, didn't you think? Maybe it wasn't hope, I said. How do you mean? I wasn't certain myself. I was thinking of all the schemes he'd had, the ones that couldn't possibly have worked, the unreal solutions to which he'd clung because there were no others, the brave and useless strokes of fantasy against a depression that was both the world's and his own. I don't know, I said. I just think things were always more difficult for him than he let on, that's all. Remember that letter? Yes, said my mother. Well, what it said was that they could force his body to march and even to kill. But what they didn't know was that he'd fooled them. He didn't live inside his body anymore. Oh, Vanessa, my mother said, you must have suspected right then. Yes, yes, but I could not go on, could not say that the letter seemed only the final heartbreaking extension of that way he'd always had, of distancing himself from the absolute unbearability of battle. I picked up the tiny saddle and turned it over in my hand. Look, the name of his branch is on this, of his ranch is on the saddle, the crisscross. What ranch, my mother said, bewildered. The one where he told me he kept his racing horses, Duchess and Firefly. Some words came into my head, a single line from a poem I had once heard. I knew it referred to a lover who did not want the morning to come, but to me it had another meaning, a different relevance. And the line was, slowly, slowly, horses of the night. The night must move like this for him, slowly, I thought, all through the days and nights. I could not know whether the land he journeyed through was inhabited by terrors, the old monster kings of the lake, or whether he had discovered at last a way for himself to make the necessary dream a perpetual dream and to live in it always. I put the saddle away once more. Gently and ruthlessly, I put it back into the cardboard box. That's the end. What should we do with the story? Do we have sponsors from you on any of the issues?
Did Julie got much?
No.
Julie got any?
One small bit.
Yeah.
Is there a gap for you? No. One small bit of one scene where he gives her another story besides the dinosaurs in the lake and the stars in the sky and his explanation for, or his awe for. Do you find him not credible, what happens to him, or that the story is too oblique? It's very obliquely done. Is that, you're thinking there's a part of the plot left out?
He didn't, I don't remember the groundwork being laid for his stuff about war, and that would drive him crazy. The groundwork is laid for his being driven crazy on the saddle, and the miniature saddle in the box is in this image. The saddle. It works lots of different ways, but the saddle representing travel in some kind of way, too. And put it in the box, but having it all be fantasy and miniature. But the war stuff, or his reaction to war, took him by surprise.
Mm-hmm. What about the rest of you? I said it had a story to do with war, and yet it was a very long development before you know, the depression when it comes down, when the war occurs, and then when she does introduce the war, it moves very swiftly. I think you're right that it's...
There's no reason to suppose that he had any politics or thoughts or morals or objections or anything.
I'm not sure it's a matter of politics. Do any of the rest of you see in the story grounds for... Within 6 months, is it not, he is in a mental hospital? Do any of you see grounds, or where it comes from, the grounds for his reaction?
There are many fantasies that were there for Chris all the way through life. It almost as though... an unreal life, unable to accept the poverty, the injustices that he saw in that, the fact that there was a lot of grandiosity that he had. And I believe that with certain kinds of mental illness, grandiosity is very often the case. And I see almost a thread of mental illness there from the very early years.
Did any of you else get a hint of that? When he goes to the war, is it willingly? This is not an issue, a great moral or political issue, is it?
It's the last thing left for him to do.
It's the last thing left for him to do.
The last thing in a long series of his dreams and aspirations just being crushed by the reality, the harshness of the reality of where he lives and the time in which he lives. And each one is sort of a little bit of reality therapy.
Well, each one is worse, you know, the choices are getting worse and worse, you know.
And the mother at the end says hope. I thought he had hope, but we can see it. It's desperation, just the flip side, don't we know? What was his first dream, or why did he come down at all?
That wasn't bad. He was going to be an engineer, and he had some nice fantasy life going with the child, but it seemed perfectly reasonable to think that he might be an engineer.
And he can't go because of what stops him.
Right.
It's a depression, isn't it? It gets worse. So how do you get the sense of him being intelligent? You get the fantasy, but I also think there's an intellect at work there where thwarting the desire to know is beginning a death of the spirit, which is analogous to the death of the body, that the actual physical fighting is. I mean, there's a slow destruction there. Did you get a sense of his being intelligent?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Very intelligent.
Yeah.
Able to ask important questions of life.
And also very likable. The children followed him all over. Mm-hmm. And that's a beautiful scene.
While she's discovering that it was all fantasy, his description of what his idyllic place was in the north.
She seems a little disappointed when she realizes that it was all fantasy because she believed it.
Yeah. What does she make of this Chris, who is her only...
Right.
She's an only child. Mm-hmm. It's his companion and perhaps first awareness of sexuality.
Right.
And he's betrayed her. Is this betrayal? Is this not betrayal? What do you make of that? Has he deceived her? Has he given her a gift?
He gave her a gift, but then she realized that the gift was almost... like the little toy saddle, it wasn't real.
That's a nice analogy. It's from a Never Never World. And on the saddle is the ranch, his imaginary ranch.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
His imaginary lake and his imaginary horses. But I believe that there are many, many times when young people do that. And I see a tremendous parallel in a lot of the poor of our time. Who will also fantasize, and some of that fantasy has to do with joining the armed forces to travel.
Living in Detroit, in the inner city, that's the dreams, however false they might be, are ways for people to cope. Whether they invest their hopes and dreams in the lottery or some fantasy of becoming a super rock star or whatever it is, it's a way for them to cope. But at the same time, it hinders them from making the kind of progress that may be within their grasp, you know, of making it up one or two notches, or whatever. I hate to use that kind of language, but reaching goals that may be within their reach. So at one time it's a coping mechanism, at the other, on the other hand, it's a way that it hinders them from
Had he not had any impediment, had he been able to go to college? I'm not sure that's a fair question to ask. It's like saying, would this be another story? The reaction or his inability, the mental breakdown, is not dependent on those early disappointments, is it? Or do you think it is?
I don't think so.
I don't either, because there are other people in the family that are living the same life that he has lived. And we're not told that there's a history of that happening to other people in his particular family.
Mm.
I think the question is, what makes some people unable to cope while others can?
Did he go out of patriotic fervor? I mean, to me, the only reaction to ending up where you are still individually involved in war, which is not the case for any kind of war we face in the future, is total and absolute. That seems a perfectly natural outcome, is to crack, because the absurdity and the grotesqueness of it is so extreme.
I think it was trying to escape. He was escaping into war.
He left Shallow Creek some months after the war began and joined the army. And she gets a letter and doesn't tell it to her mother. We do not hear from him a year later. And remember what was in the letter? They could force his body to march and even to kill, but they didn't know that he'd fooled them. He didn't live inside it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that. And 6 months after that letter, she hears that he'd been discharged from the army. He had been violent before, but now he was not violent. He was passive. And what can you deduce from that? I mean,
given up.
There's many wars, aren't there?
Yes.
What he's given up, or what battle do you think is fought in? Maybe that's too strong to say it that way. I mean, what means do people have of creating that passivity? It's not necessarily voluntarily he's become passive. What is it?
The world is beaten. Spirit.
Sounds like he's in shock.
Or shock treatment.
Right.
Which is a sure means of creating control. And that to me is an analogous to war as well. We will destroy
right.
you
mm-hmm.
if you cannot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then there's one more word after that about an emotion-laden word about reaction from war. After he becomes passive, sometimes
He was, the doctors had told us, rather passive, and then she says, violent. I could not associate the word with Chris, who had been so much the reverse. I could not bear to consider what anguish must have catapulted him into that even greater anguish. But the way he was now seemed almost worse. How might he be? Is that it? I thought this might elicit some recollections if we previously talked about the stories themselves. We've looked at relationships and moved into ways in which perhaps this is, we know the truth of this by virtue of the own truth in our lives. There are many walking wounded, are there not, from still, you know, I think. What she's drawn is a portrait of an individual after individual after individual.
There's a whole ministry to people, to Vietnam vets.
That's what I'm thinking of.
In Chicago, from time to time, they show a play or a movie that's, that brings back and opens up war memories. And then they have follow-up kinds of care and response to that. But they have a full-time staff office in Chicago. People who are there to respond to people who cracked in the Vietnam War. And how long has it been? You know, a lot of years. More than 10. And people are still just now being able to crack from their 4 years. You know, they've lived maybe 10 years as an alcoholic or as a very shut down, passive, repressed kind of person, and they can't get whole again until they can reopen it.
I have an uncle-in-law who's slowly cracking. It's taking all this time. It's finally starting to come out. I was always curious when I was smaller about his experience in Vietnam, but you could never ask him a question about it.
What I think is delicately done in this story, and it's something I haven't quite resolved for my own satisfaction, is that she does not try to recreate the horror of war for us. We have nothing from Chris of what he experienced except they think I'm fighting, but I've left my body. There's nothing else from his experiences that we are given. The only drama is given when he tells Vanessa what her father told him. And that's all we have. And that's, I think, partly in perhaps Ingrid's reaction, that there isn't enough build-up to the horror of war. It's as if it's assumed. And it's that restraint that I find remarkable. All he says is the horses in the mud going under, the way the eyes looked, and this is called Horses of the Night. I think there's no accident that this is chosen. Ever seen horses' eyes when they're afraid? I mean, really berserk with fear, like in a bushfire. And it's not just the horses, is it? I mean, who else is up to the neck in mud, eyes really berserk with fear? Your father said a guy tended to concentrate on the horses because he didn't dare think what was happening to himself or to the other men, including himself. And that's all she gives us, that's all.
It's almost like an understatement. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a part of the English background. They're masters of the understatement. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's like that.
Others of it? That's interesting.
She doesn't put it in the context of their religion or their community or the community mores or other people's. She doesn't put it in a fabric of thinking about this stuff at all, except for that one uncle's stuff. So we don't have any idea whether in his community everybody goes to war. It's assumed. I mean, war is hell, or, you know, sort of a, I mean, in my community, that's how it was. So you're sort of jaunty about it whenever you went out to war. You know, in northern Minnesota, it was just assumed all that. When you turned 18, you went into the army for lots of months. Mm-hmm. But we don't know if he came from a place like that or if he came from a place where people didn't go to war. She doesn't play any.
Well, she's given us World War II, and I suppose historically we know that in the pockets of resistance where the Mennonite community, that's over one province and up a little bit further north, that I don't think the resistance was as extreme historically for World War II, certainly not in Canada. perhaps that's why she doesn't move into it so much. I don't know. Would he have been, you know, had he been conscripted? He chose to go, and that's tied in with all the options that were denied him, were they not? Until he was going mad in his own way, I think, by virtue of having his spirit being broken. What effect would it have if he had been drafted and did not want to go? I don't know. It seems to me the story is about the fragility, which is not atypical. Is he typical or is he one in a million? No, I shouldn't say typical. I mean, is he so unusual?
I don't think so.
That degree of sensitivity, I mean, if he's unusual, then all of us would take going to battle person to person, eye to eye conflict easy, if he's unusual. That's the bell. Thank you for listening. That was Margaret Lawrence, Horses of the Night.
Thank you.